Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Good evening. I'm Ruth Ann Amartefio, and this is Feed Your Head. We have Rich Sawyer with us tonight, and he is the author of the brand new book, Breakthrough. He's going to be talking about that, transforming fear into passion. He'll be talking about his own transformation, his recent trip to Gaza, and much, much more. Hello, Rich.
Hi, Ruth Ann.
It's so good to have you here.
Thank you.
I have read most of your book, and it wasn't maybe what I expected. It's much more of a, dare I say, spiritual book than I may have expected before I opened it. Yeah, I mean, but you know how spiritual it is. But I'd like to talk a little bit about how you grew up and how you were before your breakthrough. Your transformation came several years ago. And
right.
Up until that time, you were growing up, as many Jewish children and adults in the U.S. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on the East Coast. I attended Reform Synagogue and Sunday School and Saturday School until I was 14 years old. And, you know, I just believed, like every other Jew I knew, that Israel was the safe haven for the Jewish people and that it was necessary because otherwise Jews would be subject to anti-Semitism. Now, of course, I was brought up in the aftermath of the Holocaust. I started first grade probably in 1954, so it wasn't even 10 years since the end of the Holocaust. And so, of course, among Jews, especially among the adults, our parents and grandparents, the Holocaust was fresh in their minds. I mean, you know, every Jewish family I know knew someone, had a family, at least one family member who had been in concentration camps or had escaped Europe before they had to go to concentration camps. And everybody had relatives, European relatives, who had been killed in the genocide. So obviously we saw Israel as the safe haven to the Jewish people, mm-hmm. and the only place in the world where Jews could be and not be subjected to anti-Semitism. Because even in the United States in the 1950s and 60s, there still was a lot of anti-Semitism. I mean, I experienced it, and there were institutions, there were country clubs that wouldn't allow Jews as members. So that's kind of the background. And I remember as a kid hearing people refer to Nasser, Gamal Nasser, the head of Egypt, hearing people refer to him as the Hitler of the Middle East. And of course, you know, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, when you hear someone being compared to Hitler, you automatically, especially as a kid, assume that this guy Gamal Abdel Nasser, if he's the Hitler of the Middle East, he wants to destroy Israel and kill all the Jews, and it's because he's insane like Hitler. So this was kind of the view that got that all Arabs became painted with this view. Nasser represented the Arab world, and he was the most charismatic figure in the Arab world, as a matter of fact, during that time. So as I grew up, I didn't really dwell on what was happening in Israel. Of course, in 1967, the Six-Day War, that was a real big deal, and that was when Israel defeated Jordan, Syria, and Egypt in those 6 days. And I was 19 years old at the time. That was a major event for Jews, and it was, you know, a cause for celebration because, you know, in the run-up to that war, as usual, there was talk that all these Arab countries wanted to destroy Israel. They didn't want Israel to exist. So when Israel defeated these three Arab countries, it was a great relief for everybody. And so as the years went by, I didn't really pay that much attention. I wasn't religious. I wasn't going to synagogue. But I was always aware of acts of terrorism, of what has been called terrorism, the suicide bombings that began in 1994, which ended, I believe, the last one was in 2005. But these suicide attacks were really extremely frightening, because when someone blows themselves up, when someone is so hateful towards another people that they're willing to blow, at least this is the way I saw it, that they're willing to blow themselves up, it's very scary, because they'll do anything to kill you. And if you're Jewish and you've been brought up with the belief that the world has always hated Jews, and that the world has tried to exterminate Jews, when you hear of another people or another group that is killing Israeli Jews, you feel like you're in the same, that you take it personally, as if it is you they are attempting to kill, and that if you were over there, you would be just as much a target as any of the other targets. So this framed the this kind of formed the mind of my Jewish mind. This was how I identified with Jewish history, Jewish persecution and victimization, and the Jewish people. And so whenever I would hear of acts of, I just kind of alluded to this, but when I would hear of these acts of violence directed toward Jews, and when I would hear of acts of violence directed by Jews towards Arabs, my interpretation was completely different. If a Palestinian or a member of Hezbollah from Lebanon, if any Arab attacked Jews, I saw that as unprovoked, as simply an act of blatant hatred. But if any Jew attacked Arabs, if Israel attacked Arabs, it was always self-defense. It was always necessary for security. If Israel harmed innocent people, civilians, children, it was always, my excuse was, well, they didn't really want to. They mourned the deaths of the innocent. But unfortunately, the terrorists embed themselves within their own civilian populations because they don't even care about their own people. They are so bloodthirsty and so hateful towards Israel that they're willing to sacrifice their own people in order to characterize Israel to the world as a murderer, when it is really they who are the murderers. And do you want me to go on and tell you then the event that caused... Okay. And then what happened was in 2006, in June of 2006, Hamas captured Gilad Shalit, the Israeli soldier, on the Gaza border. And this was kind of scary for me. This was just another unprovoked act by a terrorist organization that was whose philosophy was basically, could be expressed in one word, hatred. And so it really bothered me. Then 3 weeks later, Hezbollah from Lebanon conducted a cross-border raid into northern Israel and killed, I think it was, 3 Israeli soldiers and abducted 2. And this was really horrifying to me, that this organization would have the chutzpah, to use a Yiddish word, would have the chutzpah to invade Israel. And, of course, Israel retaliated immediately, and thus began what came to be known, at least in Israel, as the Second Lebanon War. And of course, when it started, Israel used immense firepower, and they displaced over 1 million Lebanese citizens. I think about 1,400 Lebanese were killed, mostly civilians, and I was justifying all of it. I saw it as necessary because I saw the combination of Hezbollah and Hamas from 3 weeks earlier. I saw them as really, I felt like they were coordinating their attack, and that these events really showed me, they really proved to me, that the Arab world would just not stop until they had exterminated Israel. They were so bloodthirsty and so obsessed with the end of Israel that they were willing to sacrifice their own people. And in the midst of this war, around the first week of this war, this war in Lebanon was about 3 weeks long. That's how long it lasted. During around the first week, I started complaining to people about it. And, of course, some of the people I complained to shared my view, some Jewish friends. But I also complained to, really, my 2 wisest friends, and neither of whom were Jewish, although both of them had plenty of Jewish friends and had grown up amongst Jewish people. But neither of them agreed with me. They criticized Israel and said that Israel was using disproportionate force, that this was always the case, that Israel had always treated Palestinians in particular unfairly. And their disagreement with me, and I guess I would say their lack of empathy for my point of view, made me even more resistant to the point of view that they were expressing. It made me even more entrenched in my view that the world hated Jews. And I even saw it as non-Jewish people, even these two wise and brilliant men, even they, because they're not Jewish, are not able to understand the suffering of our people. Those are the words I used in my mind. And and when you use language, you create a certain reality. You can convince yourself with language that something that is really not true is true. Anyway, a few days after having these conversations with my friends, I got an unexpected phone call from a longtime friend of mine who I hadn't spoken to in quite a while. And he was Jewish. He is Jewish. And he was calling me from the East Coast. At the time, I was living in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And my friend was calling me from the East Coast to tell me that he would be coming out west. He was going to be attending a bar mitzvah in Colorado. And after the bar mitzvah, he was going to drive down and see me in New Mexico. And I said, that was great. And then I launched into a tirade. I launched into basically a two-hour diatribe about how horrible the Arab world is, how obsessed it is with hatred, and how bloodthirsty it is. And during this 2 hour, and it might have even been 2.5 hours, but during this diatribe, my friend just listened. And I already knew that he had studied the subject. He had studied the history of Israel and Palestine and Lebanon and Syria and Egypt. He had studied those topics to a far greater extent than I had. In fact, I had never studied those topics. I had read one book in the mid-90s. I had read one book that was called From Time Immemorial by Joan Peters. It was about the history of Israel and the Palestinians, and it was very, very biased against Palestinians, although I thought it was just truthful. And as it turned out, it had been debunked. The book had been completely debunked as worthless propaganda, as trash. These are the words that Israeli scholars, American Jewish scholars, used to describe this one book that was like a Bible to me because it reinforced everything I wanted to believe. Right. Anyway, in my conversation with my friend, throughout my complaining, he never judged me. He never resisted my point of view. He was basically neutral and dispassionate. He didn't really show any, he didn't show any emotion, and he just kind of, he was like very accepting. And at the end of the conversation, he suggested that I read a couple of books by a couple of Israeli professors. He said, go on Amazon and look up these professors, and you'll see some good books by them, and you'll learn a lot. And I thought, and I thought that's a good idea. And so we hung up, and I realized that I had never really taken the time to study the issue, and yet I had all these strong views. And what had happened was my friend had kind of, by letting me speak and not judging me, not resisting me, and just by making a simple suggestion that was palatable, because it involved reading Jewish historians, what he had done was he had created the space for me to be willing to look, to be willing to investigate my beliefs. Now, of course, I didn't think I would find out what I eventually found out. But after we hung up, I went on Amazon and looked up these authors and saw the names of other authors who wrote on the same subject, Israel-Palestine. And I wrote down the names of the authors who I knew were Jewish. I wasn't going to read a book by someone who wasn't Jewish because I was afraid that I would suspect bias. So I went to my library and I found a couple books that appeared on the list I brought with me to the library. Came home, and I put the books down because I wasn't ready to begin reading. I decided I'd start reading the next day. So the next morning, I started reading one of the books, and I couldn't believe what I was reading, Ruthann. I mean, I knew immediately when I started reading the book that the author was a brilliant man. There was just something about the way he was writing that convinced me in the first paragraph that this was a brilliant scholar. And his documentation was very meticulous. And the sources he cited were sources I was familiar with for the most part. Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, B'Tselem, which is the Israeli Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and various other sources. And everything he said about Israel was negative. And, I mean, he was talking about political liquidation as being legal, torture in many cases, torture of Palestinian men, even when they were arrested without charge.
Right.
Just so many different horrible acts on the part of Israel. The use of lethal force, even when there was no threat of violence on the other side, even lethal force against children.
Yeah.
And this was shocking me. And while I'm reading this, though, I'm thinking, well, why isn't he saying anything negative about Palestinians? It's all negative about Israel. And the thought occurred to me that, maybe he's a self-hating Jew, which is actually a term I had never really used. But maybe he's a self-hating Jew. What's that?
I've heard that phrase. Yeah.
Yeah, self-hating Jew, or just an anti-Semite is the term that I would normally use for someone who hates Jews. Now, I wasn't sure he was he was a self-hating Jew / anti-Semite, but that was a possibility. But I also considered the possibility that the journalism that it the reports that had come out about the Israel-Palestine issue for many many years really had painted Israel as a victim, and the Palestinians as really being bloodthirsty terrorists. And I thought, well, maybe there's some stuff that maybe he just wants to report this stuff. Maybe he's exaggerating it, but, maybe he's just trying to kind of balance the equation, because everything that's been reported in the United States that I've read has been pretty positive about Israel, at least what I've read, and had been pretty negative toward Palestinians. So I kept reading. And while I was reading, I went through a series of emotions. At first, reading all these horrible things that Israel was doing to the Palestinians, I felt anger at Israel, that they were treating these people so badly, and that they were treating these people badly in the name of the Jewish people, in my name. That really got me angry. And then I realized that I had supported this behavior, that I was part of it, and that got me angry at myself. So my anger kind of turned inward on myself. And, of course, I was shocked. That was the first thing, the shock that I experienced, even before the anger came, the shock at what Israel was doing. I couldn't believe that Jewish people would do this to another people, because the Jewish people I had grown up with were not like that. I had never experienced people who were that sadistic and unfair. Anyway, so then the anger towards Israel and the anger towards myself kind of changed to embarrassment and shame at myself, that I had supported this kind of behavior, and that I had always rejected any Palestinian claims that Israel was the one acting brutally, that it was Israel that was really the aggressor, and that the Palestinians were the ones who were being victimized. I'd always just ignored that. And anything bad that Palestinians said about Israel, even about Israeli acts of violence, I always took them to be either false or taken out of context. In other words, I basically never given any credibility to the Palestinian position. So now that I'm reading this book and reading about all these horrible things, I'm starting to feel embarrassed and shamed that I had simply rejected the point of view of another people. And then I felt this wave of sorrow come over me for the suffering of the Palestinian people, all that they had endured in the name of the Jewish people, and as a result of people like me who had supported this kind of behavior. I felt like I had been as much guilty of firing a gun at Palestinians as the actual soldier in the field. So then I put the book down, Ruthann. I needed a break. I mean,
I think you probably did, because you went through a lot of
emotions. Yeah, so I needed a break, so I put the book down and just kind of closed my eyes to take a rest. And the next thing I knew, this is hard to describe, because apparently I went into a space. I can tell you this in retrospect. I went into a space of nothingness where there was no me and there was no time. and I apparently came out of this space. In other words, there was a segment of actual chronological time, as if someone had been, had a stopwatch and been timing this. There was a period of time where I was not conscious, and that by itself is obviously not unusual. People go to sleep, you know, people space out. But there was this period of time where I was where I did not exist. The best way to say it is there was a period of time that I did not exist, or where there was no time. Chronologically, if you had a video camera, you would, you know, you'd be able to count off the seconds. But right. For me, I guess you could say in psychological time, there was no me and there was no time. I came out of this space and noticed the world around me. I noticed my room, and I suddenly noticed that I didn't feel any of these negative emotions I had just experienced. I felt totally cleansed of all of these negative emotions. And I thought that was remarkable. And the reason I felt so, I mean, what was remarkable was it's not like I came out of the space dwelling on the emotions or aware of the emotions I had just experienced before I went into the space. I came out of the space and I was struck by how pure and cleansed I felt and how bright the world was. And once I noticed that, I noticed that these emotions that I had gone through were no longer impacting me in any way whatsoever. And the contrast was so stark that I had to look around my room looking for the emotions. I actually looked around my room, especially in the corners of my room, in the bookcase, looking for the anger, the shame, the embarrassment, the shock. Where are these emotions? And I couldn't find them. And then I just accepted the fact that they were gone. And I just sat there very peacefully, and I felt very blissful. And all of a sudden, I felt this as if there was a cloth. I felt like there was a cloth covering my eyes and slightly, very, very slightly pressing against my eyes. And it felt like there was a rectangular cloth. And suddenly the cloth started unraveling. It started unraveling from the left side of my face, left of my left eye, and it started unraveling in a spiral fashion. And as it unraveled, it uncovered the left eye, and then it uncovered the right eye. And it was a very soothing sensation. And then I saw that the world, once this cloth was no longer covering my eyes, I saw that the world had no qualities of its inherent qualities of its own, that the world was a reflection of my inner states of consciousness. And in other words, to a certain extent, I created the world. And then I noticed that I simply couldn't find any attachment or emotional, nostalgic quality to being Jewish. It was as if I didn't have to be Jewish. And I kind of tried to search for this Jewish identity that came with all the beliefs and images that had created this whole situation in the first place, that had put me through all these emotions in reading about things that I had always not accepted as true. And so when I couldn't find this Jewish identity, I knew that I was as much Muslim or Christian as Jewish, as much Palestinian as Israeli. And I realized my common humanity with all people. And then all these insights started arising, and I realized that fear had been the veil that had colored the way I saw the world, and that fear was part of my identity. That as long as I was had an attachment to a limited identity, an identity that said, this is who you are, and outside of this is who they are, as long as I saw the world in terms of me and the other, us against them, that there would always be fear, because anything outside of what was acceptable to the acceptable to my identity, what was acceptable to my belief system that was part of that identity, anything outside of that was a possible threat, and that was the world of us against them. And what I noticed was that this fear that colored the way I had seen the world, that this that it had to be accompanied. It was automatically accompanied by confusion, that the fear that comes with a limited identity or a limited perspective is always accompanied by confusion. So the way you see the world is not the way the world really is. And now I felt free. I was free from this identity, and I was free from the fear that accompanied the identity, and that was, and I was able to stand in the shoes of the other and see from all perspectives, because I was as much Palestinian as Israeli, as much Muslim or Christian as Jew, or Buddhist or Hindu or whatever. And then I noticed that the fear had been replaced by compassion. I could relate to, I could understand, I could feel the suffering of the other. And along with this compassion, because there was no veil that colored the way I saw the world, the compassion was inevitably accompanied by clarity. And so basically what my discovery was that as long as we're identified with a limited or exclusive identity, fear will always arise, because there is always the other, and the other always represents a threat to self. So in this dilemma of a separate self, fear is always accompanied by confusion, but it can be transformed into compassion and clarity. And that's what happened to me. And I then decided, you know, this is such an important discovery. I need to share this with everybody. And part of the discovery also included memories arising, memories of things I'd been taught as a kid and that I had just absorbed through my culture about the history of the Jewish people and the suffering of the Jewish people and the alleged hatred towards Jewish people by non-Jewish people and the alleged genocidal intentions of the Arab world and how I had been misinterpreting a lot of the history and always making Israel innocent and always making the Arab world guilty. And now I could look, I could read, I could study without a stake in the matter. I was only interested in what is true and what is false. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, what's that?
I have a question for you about that. Because you said you went to Sunday school and Saturday school and everything as a child. And so you were taught a lot about the Holocaust and this.
Growing up as a Jewish person, you get taught a lot about the Holocaust.
Right.
Not necessarily in Sunday school, just within your culture.
Then my question is, because I have an Israeli friend in Jerusalem who says that he was not taught that. He said, we don't learn about the Holocaust here like they do in the States. Have you ever heard that before?
No, I've never heard that, and that sounds ridiculous to me because Israeli school children are taken to Auschwitz and Dachau and taught all about the concentration camps. They are taught much more about the Holocaust than we were. In fact, Ruthann, I need to clarify something. I didn't say we were taught about the Holocaust in Sunday school. Okay?
No.
We weren't.
You didn't. No. You just talked about your growing up with the Jewish culture all around, and you went to a lot of the schools. But my question...
But you grow up and you know people who came from Russia and Poland and Hungary and Germany, Jewish people, and they had relatives, some very close relatives who died in the Holocaust, and some of them were in concentration camps. Obviously, you're going to learn about the Holocaust.
Sure. But I just thought it was... very remarkable that he said that he did not learn about it.
Well, maybe he didn't. You know, I don't know.
I was just wondering if you had come across anything like that. When you talked about the other, one of your book reviewers, Kathy Salton, had said that you prove that if we open our eyes to the other, we begin to feel compassion. And that was what the other, because, well, we know that a lot of systems pit us against them, whoever them is, or the other, and that this causes, I mean, so much divisiveness. So how do people get past that, Rich?
Well, I would give two answers to that. First of all, people really need to become more self-reflective, in my opinion. They need to look within, especially when it comes to strongly held beliefs, because they need to start questioning these beliefs. Mm. Any time that that a belief produces hatred or bigotry or intolerance, you really need to look within. Now, a lot of people who feel hatred towards, and we're using, in this conversation, we're talking about Arabs and Israelis, but we could be talking about white people and African Americans, especially 50 years ago. But anytime you feel hatred towards another people, you really need to question that. Where is that hatred coming from? Was I born with that hatred? Is that a necessary feeling that I should experience whenever I see someone who is, for example, an Arab or a Palestinian, or when I think about these people? Or is it something that I've been taught? And, you know, so we need to question our beliefs, number one. Number two, we can't accept what we've been taught. We really need to, well, and this is really part of the same thing, we have to question our feelings and let them guide us to a deeper understanding of the issue, and that should take us into questioning the beliefs. For example, is it really true that Israel has always wanted to make peace, but the Palestinians have always rejected Israel's overtures? Is it really true that Israel has always only defended itself against Arab hatred, and that you know, that the only reason we invaded, for example, Israel invaded Gaza was because of rockets, or the only reason Israel is is taking so much West Bank land is to protect the settlements? I mean, there's all kinds of beliefs that people have. They're justifications, and really they're propaganda. And the truth is, most people have been lied to and conned by successive Israeli governments and Hasbara mechanisms. Hasbara is the Hebrew word for propaganda.
Right.
So these are the things we really need to do. We need to question these beliefs. And as far as the history goes, anybody can find out the history. The Israel-Palestine conflict is probably the most documented conflict in the history of the world. And there's tons and tons of material, much of the historical material that anyone can read by many Jewish Israeli authors comes from Israeli State Archives, Central Zionist Archives, and other Israeli sources that are really impeccable as far as revealing what really happened. It's beginning before 1948 and all the way up till the present.
Yeah. So it's there. But so now, you know, so many people seem, at least in the U.S., maybe everywhere, to be, I don't know, if they've just given up, if they're so tired, they don't want to question themselves. Anything else. I mean, they're maybe not happy, but they're comfortable enough by going to work, coming home, watching TV.
Right, they've been numbed. Our society has taught them to basically
behave as a drone.
Allow their attention to wander towards sources of instantaneous and short-lived fulfillment. They've got TV, they've got all the smart, I mean, they've got all this technology now, but you know, we've always had TV and other sources of distraction, and you know, it's always nice when you can have an enemy. And really, I find that part of the American psyche, and certainly part of the Israeli psyche, but part of the American psyche is that the United States must always have enemies who don't believe in democracy and want to resent us for our values. And it's such bullshit. And of course we may have enemies, but we don't have enemies that just suddenly out of the blue became our enemies. If we have enemies, it's because they're angry at us for things we have done to them.
Right.
And that is kind of a form of self-inquiry. Why are these people in various parts of the world angry? Have we done anything to provoke their anger, or did they just grow up being taught to be angry? Let's find out.
Yeah. Well, you talk about that. You say that what we're having now is not really so much a political problem as a problem of identity. Then.
Yeah, I say that the political problem is real, but at a deeper level, it's a problem of identity, and that the political problem arises out of the problem of identity, out of the the unconscious creation of a world of us against them.
So I do want to mention we're talking with Rich Poyer, who is the author of Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion. How would we find your book, Rich?
The book is available at Amazon. You know, just go to Amazon.com and just type in Richard Forer, F as in Frank, O-R-E-R, and the book is available also, you know, in paperback as well as Kindle. So, it's, anybody can get it, and I hope they will, because not only does the book explain how the thought processes that go on within the minds of normally decent people, and how normally decent people can be just as guilty of, you know, gross human rights violations as anybody else. But the book also clarifies all of the arguments that one has heard within our society and within Israeli society about the Israel-Palestine conflict. It clarifies them historically with Jewish-Israeli sources. So
I was just going to mention, when you're talking about ordinary, decent human beings, I wanted to mention that you have a twin brother who lives in Israel.
Right. No, he doesn't live in Israel anymore.
Okay.
I do have relatives in Israel, but not my brother.
But he's not there now. But he is not on the same page that you are.
That's correct. He is ultra-Orthodox, and he believes that all Arabs want to kill all Jews. And he has a lot of other beliefs that I've totally refuted with historical fact, but he doesn't care about the fact, because the bottom line for him is that it clearly, and this is what he says, well, it clearly states in the Torah that God gave the land to the Jewish people, and that's the bottom line. That's it. And that, and of course, he closes any conversation, any debate, he'll close it with that. You know, belief. You know, if God gave the land to the Jewish people, that's it. End of argument. And I always try to say, well, it doesn't say in the Torah that God gave the land to the Jewish people so that they could brutalize and mistreat another people. That's not a very, enlightened perspective. That's not a very enlightened way to live, that Jews should remain so tribalistic in their view that they lose their humanity. But it doesn't matter. And my brother's view is very common. He's not unique. It's a very common view you hear. And by the way, I want to add one thing. You know, when I say ordinarily decent people, you can be a nice person, but that is not good enough. You really have to pay attention to what is going on, because it's because of apathy or wrong thinking. Wrong thinking being assuming that your indoctrination, the things you were taught, all that is correct, all that is true, and then simply standing by while another people are being mistreated, being dehumanized and demonized and character assassinated. And so it's what Hannah Arendt, the famous Jewish political theorist, she was considered probably the greatest political theorist of the first half of the 20th century, she used the term the banality of evil. And what she said was that, you know, it's not monsters that do evil things. I mean, there are monsters, but there are very few Hitlers in the world. But there's a lot of people who go along. They just go along with it, and they believe the indoctrination that their government tells them, and as a result of that indoctrination, they support policies that dehumanize and destroy and kill another people, sometimes millions of people.
Yeah, I like that banality of evil, because that's it. And you're right, just being a good person and loving your family isn't enough. So I wanted to talk a bit about, you do travel and do lectures and speeches for your book. Do you want
to talk
about that?
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
Well, I should say, you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh. Well, I do give speeches whenever I'm invited, which is not very often, and this is a source of frustration for me. I mean, there are many, many organizations in the United States, in colleges, as well as other venues, that invite people to speak on the Israel-Palestine subject. And unfortunately, they don't seem very open to the kind of perspective that I present. It's very interesting because when I do speak, people really, really get a lot out of my talk. I don't want to brag, but you know, I've spoken before a few rather sophisticated audiences of people who are highly educated and have been involved in human rights, and some of the people have said to me that that I should be speaking before the United Nations, that what I talk about is really profound. I've gotten some very ecstatic responses, and then when I tell people that I hardly ever speak and that I'm almost never invited, they're shocked. And I can tell you that I'm pretty sure that the reason I'm not invited is that the human rights movement, first of all, there's a lot of groups, but there's not a lot of people, relatively speaking. There's far fewer people involved in the human rights movement in this country than there are people involved in spiritual seeking. Mm-hmm. Okay, people who are students of A Course in Miracles, Eckhart Tolle, Wayne Dyer, and many other sources of spiritual wisdom. And what I've noticed is that the human rights groups, most of the people are not interested in the psychological reasons for why people think the way they do. They're not interested in understanding why it is that the term anti-Semite is often used to silence criticism of Israel. They don't seem to be interested in what is going through the mind of someone who would reflexively attack me, for example, of being an anti-Semite simply for expressing concern for the lives of Palestinians, or simply for criticizing illegal and inhumane behavior by the Israeli government that are clear violations of international law. For some reason, people don't want to inquire within, and they don't want to be reminded that self-inquiry is an important for the future of the world, that it's really the key to resolving conflict, and they're just not interested in a point of view that really reaches into the roots of the problem. And it's very frustrating because I don't believe that the problem will ever be solved if we don't get to the roots of the problem. And what I often say is that it's just as it is with the leaders. Like it's the you could make a case that it's the leaders, it's the politicians in our country, in Israel, in all countries, who really create all these wars, all these conflicts, when the people might just get along if it wasn't for the rhetoric and the propaganda coming from the leaders. Well, it's the same thing with the human rights groups. They do very good work, but it's the leaders who have a self-image problem. They have an identity problem because their status as being a leader becomes part of, not all leaders, but I've noticed that among many leaders, it becomes an obstruction. Their status as being a leader becomes an obstruction and becomes part of their self-image, and they're not as open to different points of view as maybe many of the followers would be. So, for example, I've had a lot of people say, I want to invite you to come speak in my city, and I'm going to see if I can get help from the local Jewish Voice for Peace or the local Sabeel organization, and they never get help. There's just no interest whatsoever. Part of it is I'm not part of the clique. I don't want to keep complaining about this, but it is a very cliquish, consciousness. And so if you're not part of this clique, and if you're not real connected with these leaders, and if your point of view is different, they don't seem interested. And, you know, Ruthann, what's amazing is that if someone comes approaches this subject with a unique point of view that is intelligent and makes sense, they're going to draw in, they're going to attract many, many more people to the subject. Exactly. Many people who may not have been that involved in the subject but are interested in, for example, in understanding the mind, the kind of mind that unwittingly supports evil. And there are also people who are tired of hearing the history talked about constantly.
Sure.
Even though that's important, but they're tired of that. They want to hear something deeper.
Yeah.
And they're being alienated from the discussion. They're being left out. And it's a problem because we need far more people to be part of this discussion if there's ever going to be any real change and freedom and justice for the Palestinians.
Right. Well, it seems like some of these leaders of these groups or the people that are higher up in them seem to have a proprietary interest in their own agenda in the group. And
yes.
So, you know, like the big whatever in the small pond kind of, they don't want infiltration of other ideas, no matter what kind of ideas it is, even though you have, you know, so many answers and it's a different way of looking at it. They like where they are. And that's unfortunate.
Right. I can give you, this may be an exaggerated case, but when I first had this transformation or awakening or whatever you want to call it, I started approaching the local human rights community that was involved in the Israel-Palestine subject. And it turned out there were a couple people who had been deeply involved for decades. And they considered themselves kind of the leaders, and other people kind of took their cue from these people, and these people immediately started saying just totally false things about me, that I didn't care about Palestinians, that people shouldn't listen to me, they shouldn't go to any of my talks. And what was going on was I realized they felt threatened that people would be attracted to another guy, to another person in the community, because they wanted to remain the top dogs. They wanted people to look to them for wisdom and knowledge. And here's this other guy who comes along, and people are getting attracted to me. And I had no interest in being a leader of any organization. I just wanted to share my message.
Right.
And yet these people really tried to sabotage my message because their self-image was more important than the lives of the people they had been fighting for decades.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, and I use this example a lot, Ruthann, you've probably heard it, in fact, but it's kind of like Americans in 2003 who were actually willing to send their children to Iraq to fight, where they would be killed, or maybe they would kill others. They were actually not, they were willing to send their children to Iraq, but they weren't willing to question their patriotic beliefs that were part of their American identity, part of their indoctrination, what they had been brought up to believe, that America stands for freedom and justice, and those dark people over there hate injustice, and they're our enemy. We have enemies all over the world, and they are our enemy. And so I'm going to send my children to go fight. I'm willing to send my children to go fight, and I'm going to silence the voices of those who speak out against invading Iraq. And that's exactly what happened in this country.
Yeah. And then when our young people get into the service, they're getting more and more, you know, against the ragheads or the little brown people or whatever, because you have to demonize someone to get another person to go kill them like that.
That's right.
It doesn't.
That is absolutely right.
It's horrid. I do want to mention your website is www.richardforer.com. And I wanted your book has so much in it. You have an interview with a lady in Israel, Leah, who started out pretty much, I would say, prejudiced against Palestinians. Do you want to tell us?
That is an understatement.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. She was a member. She was involved with Mayor Kahane from the 1970s, who was the founder of the Jewish Defense League in the United States. And I forget the name of the organization in Israel when he moved to Israel, but his organization was considered a terrorist group by the United States and Israel. And he was assassinated, but Leah was involved with his organization for quite a while.
So she was hardcore.
I guess you could say she was hardcore. Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, she wasn't that active, but she was, you know, she would attend some of their rallies, but she wasn't that, she didn't go out on the streets, I don't think, like some of the people did, and harass Palestinians.
Right, but it was an illegal organization. But what happened to her? Because she's done quite a bit of growing.
Yes, she's a very unique example. What happened was, she was living, her father was ill. And this was in the early 90s. So she and her family moved to Israel because her father had moved from New York. He had she had been brought up in New York. He was actually an immigrant from Austria, and he got out before he got out in time to avoid the Holocaust and moved to New York. Then when he was older and his kids were grown, he moved to Israel, and he was living in Ma'ale Adumim, which is one of the largest of the Jewish settlements in occupied Palestinian territory. And so he was living there, and he got sick. And so Leah and her family moved there to take care of him, and he died, and they continued living in this illegal Jewish settlement. And then in 2000, the second Intifada started, and it was a rather violent affair, whereas the first Intifada was mostly nonviolent on the part of the Palestinians. It was very violent on the part of the Israelis. But the second Intifada started when Ariel Sharon provoked the Palestinians by going up with a large entourage to the Temple Mount, the holy site of the Palestinians in Jerusalem. And that was like the starting point of the second Intifada. And during this period of time, there were some suicide bombings. And it so happened that two of Leah's daughters each had a friend who was killed in a separate suicide attack. And when this happened, she would really be upset, of course. And the way she saw it was, this is just ridiculous. The Israelis kill Palestinians, and then the Palestinians kill Israelis, and then that provokes the Israelis, who provoke the Palestinians. And it was like a ping-pong game. That's the image that she saw, defined it for her. It was like a ping-pong game. And then she thought, there's got to be a better way. And instead of becoming more hateful, which a lot of people do, you know, a lot of people, they'd hear about Jews being killed in suicide attacks, and they'd really hate the Palestinians, and it wouldn't matter to them that many, many more Palestinians were being slaughtered by Israelis. It
right.
wouldn't matter. But in Leah's case, what occurred to her was just the killing has to stop, because if we kill Palestinians, it's not like she thought we shouldn't kill Palestinians because they're human beings, too. It's just that if we kill Palestinians, they're going to kill us. So she looked in the newspaper, in the Jerusalem Post, and she discovered that there was an interfaith group that was going to be meeting at the Western Wall. And, you know, that they would be, I guess, discussing the Israel-Palestine problem and try to, you know, find common ground. And she decided she would go to this meeting. And her friends told her that she shouldn't go because the Arabs would kill her. And she said, no, I'm going to go. I think it'll be okay. And they said, well, just make sure when you talk to an Arab, because that's the term they use for Palestinians. They don't use Palestinian. They just use the generic term.
Dehumanizing again.
Her friends said, what's that?
No, that's another form of, like, dehumanizing. I mean, they say Palestine never existed, so Palestinians don't exist.
Right. Some say that. Anyway, so her friend said, if you're going to talk to an Arab, just make sure you don't turn your back on him or her, because they'll stab you, literally. So anyway, she went to this meeting and at the Western Wall, and she said it was just wonderful. There were Jews, Christians, Muslims, there were Palestinians, Israelis, and she said she spoke with these young Palestinian men who showed her their scars from being shot by Israelis, and they would tell her, well, there was a curfew, but I had to go out and get some milk, and a soldier shot me while I was going to the store, you know, all these stories. And then there was this one young Palestinian man who was talking to her, and he picked up the dirt, and he let it fall through his hands, and he said to her, I love this land. And she said, she realized in that moment she couldn't hate someone who loved the land as much as she did. And so she became involved with this dialogue group, and for many, many years, she herself held a dialogue group in Ma'ale Adumim, in her apartment in Ma'ale Adumim, Palestinians and Israelis, Israeli Jews and Palestinians. And she's become very close with many Palestinians. She's visited them in their homes, and she believes in a one-state solution. She believes that Palestinians and Israelis should be able to live side by side anywhere in the country. So it's quite a remarkable transformation. She used to see the Palestinians as dogs, which is what Mayor Kahani used to say.
Yeah, your interview with her made me cry, especially that you mentioned with the soil. That's it. It seems like the governments try to keep us from finding the commonalities and that we have with other people, because the governments benefit more from divisiveness. But I want to say once more, this is Richard Rohr. He has written Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion, and you can find it at Amazon. The book is on Kindle and it's in paperback. And also, go to his website, richardforer.com, and be prepared. There's a lot there. You have really almost embarked on a whole other life since. Now, you went to the West Bank in 2010, and in 2012, you went to the West Bank and Gaza. But since your transformation, your breakthrough in 2006, your life has really changed.
Yeah, I guess you could say my life has changed. I never expected to be an author. I never expected that I would be speaking publicly, although I don't do it very often, but still I do it. And I never really expected I would be that engaged in this issue.
Well, right. I mean, growing up and having the beliefs you had, if somebody 20 years would have told you, you know, 20 years ago would have told you what you'd be doing now, you'd have laughed at them. And yet, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. I probably would have. Yeah, I would have just been incredulous, I guess.
Yeah. What about your family? I haven't asked you. Your close family, now we've heard about your brother, but other family members, what do they think about what you're doing?
Well, the bulk, most of my family has died off. I have another brother who is, you know, he's sort of accepting. He doesn't really have an opinion one way or the other. He's very diplomatic, I guess.
Okay.
And then my twin brother has 8 children. None of them agree with me. Some of them are very hostile to me. And some of them, you know, we just don't talk. And some of them we get along, but we just don't talk about it.
Yeah.
Just don't talk about the subject.
So they all
hate Arabs, and they all believe that, you know, because they're religious, they all believe that the land belongs to Israel because God gave the Jews the land, and that's it. And there's no wisdom. There's no understanding that there's more to life than just owning something. It's the most materialistic religious belief you could have, and yet they use God as the source of the belief and don't even know that they're being materialistic.
Yeah, well, that's it. When we're in it, you know, that whole thing about seeing the forest for the trees, when we're in something deeply in a belief like that, we really, I mean, it takes something to shake us out of it. And you were fortunate with your wise friend who didn't fight you over it, but just made a suggestion, and you took him up on it and did a complete...
But you have to have somewhat of an open mind if you're going to end suffering. If you don't have an open mind, you're going to stay, you're never going to grow, and you're always going to be a victim, really, of your own mind. And I want to say that the real enemy is not Israel. The real enemy is not the Palestinians. The real enemy is the unexamined mind that projects its suffering onto the world and then blames the world for its suffering. And in this situation, the Israel-Palestine conflict, it just so happens that this unexamined mind exists more with the Israeli side, because the Israeli side is the side that is clouding the history, that it is the side that is distorting the history. The Palestinians live the history. They don't have to lie about anything because their daily lives are brutal, prove the brutality of this illegal occupation.
It's right there. Rich, thank you so much for coming on. And
you're welcome.
I want to keep in touch with you, and we will do that. So
definitely. I would love that.
A lot of good information. So please.
Thank you, Ruthann.
I'm just suggesting that people check out Breakthrough, Transforming Fear into Compassion. Good night, my friend.
Good night, Ruthann. Thank you again. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Ruth Ann Amartefio, and we're back. Feed Your Pet. And this hour, we have Patrick LeBay, who is coming to us from South Carolina. I believe you're still in South Carolina, aren't you? Hello, Patrick.
Yeah. Yeah, hi.
Okay. It's good to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
Well, I should say we've got two websites for him. So one is socialistpartysc.org, and the other is SomervilleJewishCommunity.com. And like I had written, we're talking about politics and religion, two of my favorite things. So we all know what the other one is, but we're not getting into that tonight.
Well,
so,
no.
Oh, darn.
Darn.
I'd like to just talk about how you came to Reform Judaism, because and talk a little bit about what that is. A lot of people don't know. I mean, they just lump all the Jewish religions together, whether it's Orthodox, religious, Reform, non-religious but Jewish, whatever. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, I came to Reform Judaism. Basically, the reason I'm a Reform Jew is because it matches well with my own political philosophy, which I'm a socialist. And Reform Judaism is the more liberal branch of Judaism. Matter of fact, in Europe, a lot of the, instead of calling them Reform synagogues, they call them progressive or liberal synagogues, rather than using the word Reform. Reform came about in the early 1800s. It was a movement in Germany to kind of update the religion and to be more socially active. You know, that was a whole time in Europe when people were getting more socially aware in the 1800s. You know, you had Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels writing on political philosophy and making the world a better place through politics. And you had a lot of Jews that wanted to be more socially active, more, you know, activist in the community, making the world a better place, which is really the core of all Jewish faith, is to try to make the world a better place. So Reform really goes the extra mile in that sense. So that's how I came to Reform Judaism.
Oh, okay. So your socialism came first.
Yeah, over the years, right. Over the years, for a long time I was active in the Democratic Party, but I saw the Democratic Party as just Republican light, so to speak.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans are all one party in my mind. They're just like different divisions of the same party.
I agree. Yeah, yeah.
Two-sided
blade, yeah.
Right. You know, they're both capitalist parties, you know, and capitalism is about capital or money. Socialism is about society or the workers, the ones who produce in society, the social structure. So there's a big difference. There's the big difference between capitalism and socialism.
Right. And you may have been like I was lied to enormously growing up just by the what we were taught in school and what it was assumed. You mentioned socialist or communist, and it's like, oh my God, you know, and I had to grow up, you know, start looking around myself to find out how much I've been lied to, and it's not pleasant. But
you know, we were never taught in school about people like Eugene Debs, for example.
No.
Who was a great American hero, but how many people other than maybe of our persuasion even know about Eugene Debs?
Right, who got something like 1 million votes for president while he was in prison?
Right.
On the ticket? Yeah.
You know, we're not teaching in schools that. I was fortunate to go to a high school that did expose us to those things. I had a teacher who was an avowed Marxist, I was exposed early on to a lot of political philosophies.
That's wonderful. I just went to a small school in a small town and nothing like that. And I don't blame my teachers, because they had they were teaching what they'd been taught, but
exactly
what they hadn't been taught was how to open their minds.
Well, you know people hear the word socialism and they think about countries like North Korea, which is not a socialist country,
right?
By any means, it's a totalitarian dictatorship.
Yeah,
I always use the analogy of this. If a dog calls itself a cat, it's still a dog.
Okay. True.
So people that we've had countries like the USSR, which was not a socialist country. You know, it may have started out that way. You know, Lenin had good ideas, Trotsky. But when Stalin came to power, it became a statist country. It became a repressive totalitarian regime. And until recent days, last 30 years, that's the way it remained. But it wasn't a socialist country, even though it called themselves socialist. They weren't
right.
Socialist.
Well, that's it.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, too many people see that and they see that name and they say, oh, that's socialism. You know, or on the other hand, and I'm not popular with this statement, you know, Hugo Chavez was creating a socialist country in Venezuela. I mean, a true socialist country.
Yeah.
Cuba is the closest thing I think we have to a socialist country in the world. You know, they've done, you know, Cuba's actually done some phenomenal things, but we Americans don't hear about the good things about Cuba.
Exactly. You have to search. And when you do, it's, you know, people are amazed. I tell people that when we had Katrina, Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, most people, like 99.9% of the people in this country, don't realize that Cuba offered to send something like 500 doctors to help.
Yes.
But you're not going to hear that. Oh, the United States turned them down flat. I mean, God knows we can't have any Cubans helping us. You know, things like that angers me, because even the treatment that we've given that poor country with this stupid embargo for all these years, still, they have the humaneness, the compassion. They wanted to help. They offered to help.
And the other thing you don't hear about Cuba, and it's very interesting, is they have, we're talking about religion and politics, they have freedom of religion in Cuba. They have large Catholic congregations. They have two large Jewish congregations, one in Havana, and I'm not sure where the other one is. They have a lot of freedom of religion in Cuba, but you don't hear about that.
You don't
that.
Hear, no. You don't, you know, it's it would be funny if it weren't just so sad. When you try to tell people in this country some of these things, and, I mean, they just refuse to believe you. Maybe they're not going to call you a liar, but they're saying, well, you're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about, because they're so indoctrinated by this propaganda.
Well, the other thing, too, is I always tell people, our biggest trading partner for the United States is China.
Mm-hmm.
China is a totalitarian regime, much worse than Cuba. And yet Cuba sits 90 miles off our coast and we embargo Cuba.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
Absolutely none. It's
the only reason we didn't embargo Venezuela when Hugo Chavez came to power is because of the oil.
Yes.
Because, I believe it's Citgo is... When you buy oil from Citgo, you're buying Venezuelan oil. You know, when you buy gas from Citgo station.
Right.
But, you know, they had a lot of oil. So, of course, you know, it's always about oil. Iraq, about oil. You know, Afghanistan, about a oil pipeline through Afghanistan. You know, it's always about oil. You know,
Or maybe some other kind of resources they want to steal. But it's definitely... not for any other reasons. And when the United States and some other Western countries use the excuse of humanitarian reasons to invade countries like Libya and things, you know, that is just such total bullshit. That way, saying it like that, you get more people on the side of it. I say, well, you know, those people, they've been, you know, their government's been so terrible to them, we're going to go in and liberate them. And, you know, so then the American people who are dumbed down, numbed down, watching MSN, they think, well, yeah, then that's probably a good thing.
Well, you know, I always point out to people, and you know this, terrible, terrible humanitarian crisis in Rwanda a few years ago.
Mm.
If Rwanda had had oil, we'd have been in there.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
In it, and also racism plays a part. Rwanda was African.
Was really black. Mm-hmm.
Really black, really dark skinned. So we have less. Our government has less concern about the people who are, you know, the people of color in this world than they do about the quote what they consider the white people.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, when you will open your mind and look around, it's so many things fall into place and make sense. Not in a good way, but I mean that you understand where the government's coming from and what's going on.
And Obama has been a major disappointment.
Oh.
Because he, you know, I really, even as a socialist, I liked Obama when he was running in 08. I thought, you know, this guy's got some ideas, you know, he's the lesser of two evils, and then he just continued Bush's policies. He said he was going to close Guantanamo on day one. Guantanamo is still there.
Well, it's still there, and they built some big addition to it, and now we have something like 20-some prisoners in Guantanamo who are on they're fasting. So, treatment. And it's just like, my goodness, why can't we just send these people back home? Like that young man from Canada who was 15 when they put him in there. You know, he's 25 years old. He's missed so much time. He'll never be able to gain that back. I mean, those formative years he spent in prison on an island that we don't even have diplomatic relationships. I mean, you know, it's like, it is too convoluted, Patrick. Nobody writes this stuff.
And the untold story that people don't hear is about all the Americans that are in being held without trial here in the United States for, quote, terrorism charges. Where I live in South Carolina, for example, the next town over is the naval brig over at in Goose Creek, South Carolina. They were hold. That's where they held. Can't think of his name. The guy from Chicago, the Hispanic gentleman from Chicago. He's been since released. But they are holding. My neighbor is a chaplain at that base, and he told me they're holding about 12 Americans there on terrorist charges.
Oh.
These people have not even been tried. You know. Supposedly, in the United States, you have constitutional rights, habeas corpus.
Right.
You know, but under the Patriot Act, anyone, you, me, anyone can be arrested and held without trial in prison.
Yeah. It's just not, this isn't the country that I thought I grew up in. I don't know if that country ever existed. You know,
well,
more and more.
The American dream has become the American nightmare, especially for those without money and influence.
Yeah.
You know, I always point out, I work in a prison. You know, I've worked in prisons, and this is my new job up here in North Carolina. I work in medical in a prison.
Okay.
And I always point out to people, I use the O.J. Simpson trial as an example. Now, I'm not saying whether he was guilty or innocent. I'm not taking a stance that way. But if a black man without money gets arrested, he ain't going to get off. Not in this country. But O.J. Simpson had money. It's not even about race anymore in this country. It's about economics. It's not about, really, I tell people this is not about race. It's about economics. And the corporate interests in this country keep people divided on the race issue. But it's about economics. And the white people in this country and the African-Americans got to realize they have more in common with each other rather than fighting each other, rather than dealing with, I say it's a false thing of racism, because what they do is they use the race card to keep the workers divided.
Yes, and anything they can use to cause divisiveness, they will. And that, I wanted to segue back to your congregation, the Somerville Jewish community, because the picture of that community, I love it. I mean, it looks like a mini United Nations with...
Yeah, it really is. And the thing is, that's true. And people don't realize, going back to Judaism, that there are Jews all over the world. In India, there are Jews in China, there are Jews in Africa. You know, the Ethiopian Jews is a well-known example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jews come in all colors. You know, I like to say we're a rainbow.
Yeah.
You know, and not the typical idea, you know, what people typically think.
Exactly. And you had said before on our show that part of what Reform Jews believe is that the Jewish law should probably undergo an initial evaluation and renewal. Because...
Yeah, and...
Go ahead.
And that's what Reform does. Reform is very, like, for example, tonight, and I want to bring this up because I've attended the local congregation here in Charlotte where I'm living, and the rabbi, she had some really nice things to say about Passover coming. And throughout the service, she mentioned the Palestinians and the need for peace, an equitable peace with the Palestinians, something equitable. You know, the reality of the world is, and I know a lot of people say, well, you know, the Jews shouldn't be in that land. Well, I disagree, but the reality is we're there. Now,
well,
the reality is...
Deal with what is. Yeah.
Well, you got to deal with what is. You know, 6 million Jews are not... Oh, I don't know what the population of Israel is. I don't know if it's 6 million. But however many Jews in Israel, I'm not going to leave Israel. I'm not going to pack up and go.
Right.
No matter what. But we have to work towards a equitable solution so that the Jewish people in Israel and the Palestinians in the Palestinian territories can live in peace, in independence, and in cooperation with each other. And we need to get rid of the radicals on both sides. And when I say the radicals, I'm talking about the government of Israel. You know,
well, right. It's a Zionist
policy.
It's Zionist. There's no... I mean, I'm not saying everybody in the government is Zionist, but a lot are.
Well, you know, the word Zionist has been mutilated over the years.
Well, I mean, when I use it, I don't mean anything to do with religion, but the socioeconomic entity, the political arm.
Right. Well, that's why you could, you know, I always say, you know, I'm an American, okay? I'm proud to be an American, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I really am. However, just because I'm American, I don't necessarily support what my government does, which I don't.
Yeah.
I'm a Jew. I support Israel. I support Israel in the sense of a homeland for our people, especially after the Holocaust. But I don't necessarily support everything the government does, which I don't. I mean, we have a very bad situation over there in Israel for the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Well, it's very bad. And I think that... Without some of the government leaders, the people will work things out. I don't like how Palestine was just ripped away from the Palestinians. I think that was abominable. But right now, like you said, things are, you know, people are where they are. We have a lot of Israeli pro-Palestinian activists. We had one on our show Wednesday night, my friend Sarit from Israel, who lives in the United States, and she interviewed him. And, you know, I think that those people are the ones who are truly the heroes, because it's very hard to be Israeli and in Israel and be pro-Palestinian. But there's more.
But, you know, the friends I have in Israel, most of them will tell you that they are not anti-Palestinian. They are anti-terrorist. They're anti, you know, Hamas, let's say, but not anti-Palestinian. If we can get the radicals on both sides off of the table and the people, And again, this gets back to socialism, the people, the workers, the working class. They're not running countries.
No,
the countries are run by oligarchies.
They're too busy working. right now, I think we both know Jarek, who is he has a Facebook page called Automation Socialism. And with this theory, and actually it would work, you know, because we are going more and more into mechanized things in factories and elsewhere, that, you know, it comes down to probably people could work about 2 hours a day under this type of socialism, and you would have the rest of the time to actually do something that makes your heart sing, whether you're writing, making music, spending time with your family and friends. You know, this can happen, but it takes a lot of cooperation.
But the corporations aren't going to let it happen.
See,
those controlling the economy are not going to let it happen.
I
saw on TV the other day, they're talking about the Dow is at the highest it's ever been, which it is. However, how's that helping people like me and you and people at the bottom? I say people at the bottom of the pile, and I put myself at the bottom of the pile.
Oh, yeah.
How is that helping us?
You're right.
I don't care if the Dow's 100,000. It's not helping us.
Mm-mm.
The banksters are getting away with murder. They got all those billions of dollars, but they're still going after people who are facing losing their houses.
Yeah. At this point in time, this makes no sense, Patrick. We're building.
The socialist solution to saving the banks would have been one of two things. A, nationalizing the banks. That would have been the best thing. But if you're going to do the bailout, they should have given the money to the people to pay their mortgages. The banks still would have got the money. They would not have got the losses, but the people would not be covered in debt. But they want to keep us covered in debt because, you know, they keep us dumb and stupid.
Well, that's the name of the game. And believing all the commercials on TV. I don't have TVs. I don't miss that. Now, isn't it North Dakota that actually has the state bank?
Yes, it is.
North Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all of our states, North Dakota is doing it right. It's like,
but who wants to live in North Dakota? It's too cold.
Hey, man, don't do that. I spent, several months. I didn't spend a whole year there, but years ago I did live up there. And you know what? I found such nice people. When you first meet them, there's a lot of, Scandinavian people in the area I was in. So they were a little, not cold, but withdrawn until you could get to know them a little, but such very, very good people. And North Dakota is wonderful, but I was there in the winter. Yes, they sent people from my workplace to pick us up on snowmobiles.
It's not my cup of tea. I'd rather, maybe if we could take those people and move them to the south and move these, I hate to say it, these dumb redneck southerners up there, then maybe we'd have the south would be a better place. I like the weather here.
And Illinois, I don't know, this is our second winter that hasn't really been winter. I mean, it's gotten cold. I had a decent snow the other day here, but that's it. Climate change is alive and well and very here.
And when the people call it global warming, they're wrong. It's not global warming, it's climate change.
It's climate change, yeah.
It creates things like Hurricane Sandy. It creates these huge snowstorms and then these blistering summers.
Well,
it is
so much fire, more wildfires and things like that. Yeah, it's just totally the...
You know that volcanoes, for example, have earthquakes and volcanoes. I believe the statistic is somewhat like 10 times as many volcanoes and earthquakes since the early 1900s that there were in the history of the world prior.
Wow,
the history of history, but not going back a million years, but back to recorded history, and that's all climate change, and some of it is natural, some of it is not man-made, but the man-made part of it is worsening the natural part of it,
that,
and this is what people don't get. the man-made, we're destroying the Mother Earth. We really are.
Yeah. It's I did not know until you mentioned this a while ago that you work at a prison. Is this like a federal, or is it a maximum security, or
a maximum security state prison here in North Carolina? I just started 2 weeks ago here, although I've worked in prisons in the past as well.
Right, I knew you had started the new job. So do you find any kind of, what do I want to say, political movements there?
Not really, no. Not really. I haven't seen it in this particular prison. Now, I used to work on death row in South Carolina a number of years ago.
Oh.
And that was probably one of the most rewarding jobs I had. It really was. I really enjoyed it in the sense that I felt like I was doing something to make the world a better place, to make these guys' lives a little bit better, because it's a horrific life. I remember one inmate telling me, you know, the worst part about being on death row is they keep you here 10, 20 years before they execute you.
Yeah, yeah, that is inhumane treatment. There's a problem with that, yeah.
But you know, we're the only Western country, I believe, and I could be wrong on this, that has a death penalty.
I think you're right.
You know,
when it comes to, you know, humane treatment and, well, just many things, that we were brought up thinking that the United States was number one in so many things, from education to health care to humaneness, and just right down the list. And now, if you look at the list, no matter what it is, the United States is not in the top 10, except something like this. All the other,
yeah, or in gun violence. And we can talk about gun violence. I'll tell you what, we're number one in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, but, you know, I always say the NRA is the largest terrorist organization in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
I think it's US gun myself, but, you know, whatever. That, how do you think that, you know, I have a few young friends, 19, 20, 21, who are adamant socialists. And one is, he's got a group started at his community college that he just, this is his first year there. He's got a group of young socialists going. And, you know, it's good to see this, but how is this the way we're going to do it? I mean, start with the youngsters. What do you think? How are we going to get more people involved?
It's all about, first and foremost, it's about education, educating people about what socialism really is, getting beyond the rhetoric of, you know, showing, you know, if you read Marx and Engels, I mean, they spell it out really good. Now, you know, they've gotten a bad rap over the years in history, but, you know, you read their writings in their purest form, not the interpretation of other people, but what they said, you know, getting the workers to unite, you know. The workers produce the products. They produce the economy, but yet they get the least from the economy. Now,
right.
I'm not totally against, you know, and socialism isn't totally against people owning and running businesses.
Right.
I mean, that's another misnomer. I mean, obviously you need people with capital to start businesses to employ people. That goes without saying. But the disparity between the workers and the CEOs, I mean, it's what, 300, the work CEOs make 300 times what the workers make?
Yeah.
You know, and unions are on the decline in this country at one time, you know.
Yeah, that's a big problem. The unions have been so downgraded by, you know, whatever methods they produce.
Well, the so-called right-to-work states, which is a right to fire, right to not organize, have destroyed the unions. And and to be honest, the unions have not helped themselves either in some aspects.
Yeah.
The corruption at the high levels in some of the unions have hurt the image of the unions and have played into the capitalist game. I mean, so But yeah, unions are why we don't have child labor in this country. Unions are why we have 40-hour work weeks in this country. Unions are why we have overtime if we work more than 40 hours. You know, that's all, you know, if you like those things, you need to thank the unions. You need to thank socialism. That's what the unions were a socialist movement in this country.
Right. There's been a poster you probably seen on Facebook. It says, if you enjoy it, list about 20 or 30 different things. And like you said, you know, 40 hour week, no child labor, blah, blah. Thank the unions. They did wonderful. And see, but this is the problem. Then people say, well, we've got all that stuff now, so we don't need the unions. And they don't seem to realize that this is coming back. People are working more time now. Many people in offices and all are expected to work longer hours with no extra pay. It's creeping back because there is no strong union to stop it.
Well, just listen to the last Republican primary, Newt Gingrich talking about putting kids to work.
Mm.
You know, I mean, 30 years ago, even a Republican wouldn't have got away with saying that.
Yeah.
But people cheered him. People cheered him. You know, I mean, the whole thing that gets me is when these people who vote, especially for the Republicans, but the Democrats, like we said, are just about as bad, but they vote against their own self-best interest.
I know.
They're brainwashed.
Yes.
The system brainwashes people. I was just listening to an interview on, believe it or not, and I won't say the network, but you know which network I'm talking about. They were interviewing Paul Ryan about his budget plan. It was horrific.
I won't know the network because I don't watch TV because they got rid of them. But probably it could come from almost any of them because from what I hear, they're all full of it.
But, you know, we're in the 21st century, and we're taking steps back to the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And
go ahead.
And we need a socialist revolution in this country. I'm not saying an armed revolution. That's not what I'm advocating. But I'm saying a revolution of thought, a revolution of mind, a revolution of education, so that people are educated. And if people become educated, they're going to start voting the correct way. They're going to you'll see socialists getting a million votes or more. You know, you'll see people in Congress who are actually socialists. You know, we have only Bernie Sanders in Congress who says he's a socialist. And Bernie's pretty good on a lot of things. So I'm not going to criticize Bernie Sanders. I do like him. But
yep.
He's still a bit of a corporatist.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
he's the best one in Congress right now. I mean, you know, and there's a couple of Democrats I like Sherrod Brown is pretty good, and Alan Grayson in Florida, I think he's great. I honestly do.
Yeah,
but we're
not saying that everybody who is in Congress is a complete jerk. I'm saying most of them seem to be because they're not voting for the interests of the people who put them there. They don't care. And people have become so apathetic about voting that they probably won't vote part of them out. They'll just sit on the couch watching mainstream media and saying, oh, God, what's the world coming to? And not do a thing about it.
But the revolution in this country is going to come, and it may take 50 or 60 years. Unfortunately, I probably won't live to see it. But the revolution in this country is going to come because of the internet. Because
with
the internet now, like we're talking over the internet,
people
all over the world can hear us.
That's right.
And they don't have to be, you know, if you're talking like I've done interviews on local stations, and of course you're only reaching the local audience. But with the internet, we're reaching millions and millions of people all over the world.
Right. And that's what alternative media does. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the internet has become the way people actually get information other than the main networks, the mainstream or lamestream media.
Yeah.
You know, So I think that that will help bring about a socialist revolution in really, and you know, we're talking about the United States, but really when you're talking about socialism, we have to talk about internationalism.
Definitely. Yes.
It has to happen in every country. It has to happen in every country. You know, we have to make the world a better place, and the way to make the world a better place is to be focused on the social aspects of society. You know, we have people, and I've seen it because I've done home health, for example, in hospice as a nurse, and I've seen people living in the most squalor conditions, and I think to myself, this is America?
Yeah.
We have people living like this? I have been to homes that still had outhouses in rural South Carolina. I am not kidding you.
Oh, no, totally. I know that, yeah.
I mean, squalor, shacks, squalor conditions, and yet this is America? This is supposed to be, quote, the greatest country in the world, which we know it's not, unfortunately.
Right.
And I get all the time on the Internet when I'm blogging on different places, I get people saying, well, if you're not socialist, go move to Cuba, go move to Venezuela. But that's not the point. The point is we need to make the world a better place where we're at.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I could move to Cuba or I could move to Venezuela and I'd probably be happier, but I'm an American, I love my country, and because I love my country, I want to make my country a better place.
Yeah.
You know,
I understand that. Recently I was thinking of moving to another country, but I talked with friends and I was just having that nagging feeling about, well, I should stay and work on it right here. I am not a nationalistic person. I used to be, but I think for us to make the world a better place, we've got to leave some of that nationalism behind. But I have a friend who's in Bangladesh who is talking, you know, just like you said, that we have to cooperate. I mean, this has to come to all countries. And I think it will.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's going to take 50 or 60 years because, like you said, the Internet has made such difference in our lives. And, you know, I mean, I talk on Skype with people around the world every day,
mm-hmm.
you know, different countries. And it's wonderful. So I think that is
well,
I don't
you
think
know,
it takes that long.
Mm. You know, we can have national pride, and there's nothing wrong with national pride.
There's nothing wrong with
you
national
can be
pride.
Proud to be an American, proud to be a Canadian, proud to be a German, whatever it is. But that doesn't make you necessarily a nationalist. But we can have national pride, but we can be international in our perspective. You know, I think, you know, if you go way back to after World War One, that was the whole idea behind the League of Nations. Unfortunately, it failed because our country did not ratify it. And the League of Nations failed because of different things that they did. But the idea of the League of Nations was to have national pride, but be international in our perspective.
Well, the League of Nations was the precursor to the United Nations, which somebody, I forget what they were calling it, but many people have no faith in the United Nations because the U.S. still controls so much of it with veto power. So,
well, you know, you're right, yeah. But, you know, the problem with the United Nations is you get countries coming in there, and the United States is a terrible example of it. But you get the countries coming in there that are pushing their agendas, and they're not pushing international cooperation.
Well, that's
the United States.
I mean, the United States doesn't do anything for any other country unless, you know, they've got some kind of closed treaty or maybe even a treaty that we know of, but because they don't care, just like we talked earlier about the humane purposes of the things, they could care less.
Iraq is a perfect example. I mean, we supported Saddam Hussein for years and years, giving him weapons and money and everything else, and then all of a sudden he wasn't cooperating with us. So
exactly.
We're gonna go after him, and you know, and a million Iraqis died as a result of the U.S. invasion. That statistic doesn't get told a lot.
Well, babies are still being born with birth defects because of that.
and
it's going to take a long time to heal.
You know, had Hitler survived World War II, he would have been tried and executed. Yet we have Bush and Cheney, who started an unnecessary war in Iraq that killed a million civilians, and they're not only not in jail, they're out talking on TV and writing books and whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but they're war criminals. Bush and Cheney are both war criminals.
Yeah. And what Tony Blair, there's a few others that, you know, people will talk about being war criminals, and nothing is being done about that. It's just, well, that's the way it is. But, you know, they intentionally did this behind lies, and they knew they were lies. So, you know, where to go?
And they sold the American people on lies. They sold the American people on lies.
Well, they've already dumbed down the population. This is the thing. You know, it's for the corporations to have people who will work for them who are pretty much just in the drone mode. I mean, go to work, come home, watch something absolutely asinine on TV, go to sleep, get up, go to work, come home, over and over again. Don't think. Don't think. That is their enemy. Open mind.
Well, and again, we go back to the same thing. Education. The only way the working class is going to rise up with their votes, with their voices, is that they're educated as to what the real story is. But the mainstream media doesn't educate people, and people are so busy working, trying to make a living, living from paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, the American dream has become an American nightmare for the vast majority of people in this country.
It's people now are, you know, they used to say, like, well, and I don't know how many, you know, decades ago, but people would think that as they got older, they were more established, they had more money, they had this and this, so they were looking forward to having plenty when they decided to leave their jobs or not. Now it's not that way. People aren't gaining as they grow older. And our kids coming out of college, well, they're not kids, but you know, adults, but they can't find work.
And they're loaded up with debt.
With debt, over $100,000.
And you know, do you know this? And I discovered something the other day which I did not know. Bankruptcy law. You know how you can declare bankruptcy and get rid of your debt.
Except on student debt.
Except student loans. Exactly.
Oh, I know. I know. That totally freaked me out too when I found that out. It's like, well, man, so they've just got, because that is the largest debt that most of these people will ever have.
Well, you know, I know physicians that come out to start their practice, and everyone says, well, physicians make a lot of money. But, you know, a lot of physicians start their practice, and they have $2 million or more in debt.
Yes. Yeah.
For their education.
And then they have high insurance, malpractice insurance, and all this stuff. So, yeah, I mean, if they get it paid off by the time they're 50, they're lucky.
Well, and see, in Europe, in many countries in Europe, and Sweden is one that I know of, you can go all the way through college and medical school, and as long as you maintain your grades, you graduate medical school with no debt.
Debt free. I know.
The government pays the whole.
Our education should be free. Yes.
And the medical costs in Sweden are much lower because physicians don't have to charge as much because they can make a decent living. Same, and it's the same in France also, to be correct. But we have a system, you know, that, you know, like I said, you know, I know a lot of physicians, and I know they're struggling as bad as I'm struggling because they have all this debt to pay off. You know, and most physicians go into medicine just like most nurses go into nursing because they want to help people. That's the motivation. Because if they don't have that motivation, they're not going to make it through medical school, I guarantee you. I mean, they're just not going to. They have to have a real inner motivation. It's not to make money. You know, most physicians I know are not in there to make money.
Yeah.
But they load it up with so much debt that it's ridiculous. And again, this is why we need socialism in this country.
Yeah. You know, we have things that are socialistic like the fire department, the police department, these kind of
absolutely.
Things. The road.
Absolutely.
But people don't look at that. But, you know, when you start pointing it out to them, well, that's what it is, then it's like, wow.
Well, the whole military is a socialist institution.
Mm.
When you think about it, what they get their food, they get their health care, and they, you know, they work, they do they get their clothes, they get their health care. You know, it's a socialist system. It's the largest social system we have in this country. People don't see it that way. They don't understand what socialism is about. Socialism is providing for the people. It's not saying people are going to be lazy and sit on their butts. Nobody wants that. And that shouldn't be tolerated. People should do what they're able to do.
Exactly.
In society. It makes society a better place.
Well, and most people
shouldn't have to worry about the paycheck. They shouldn't have to worry about paying the bills. They shouldn't have to worry about losing their house because
right.
the economy takes a dive. You know,
right.
they shouldn't have to worry about how are they going to put food on the table for the kids. You know, this has become, and having been out of work a long time prior to getting this job, I know it firsthand. I know these things firsthand. And it's a real eye-opener. Most people, I'd say 90% of the working class live paycheck to paycheck. And once they lose their job within two paychecks, they're sunk.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just shouldn't be that. Like you say, I mean, your whole mental state should not revolve around being able to make the house payment, pay the rent, feed the kids, whatever. That's just wrong. And it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't. I think we would have there again, and I'm not saying to do away with, but I think we would have a lot less crime if...
Oh, yeah.
People were, they knew, I mean, whether we have a guaranteed income or whatever you want to call it, but if they knew that there was going to be food next week, they know that, and they're going to be able to put the kids in clothes, and the school is free, and all of this, if they knew these things, I just think there'd be much less crime, and people would be so much happier.
Well, you know, crime is about economics. For the most part. Now, that's not 100% obviously, but I deal with people, convicted criminals every day, and I've done it on and off for years, and in many, 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 most cases, it has to do with economics. It has to do with why do they go out and sell drugs? Because they can't find a job. They make selling drugs a doesn't mean it's right to do, but what choice do people have? They have to make ends meet. They have to.
I know that
children.
There's money in that. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they turn to a life of crime, and then they get sucked into that life of crime. And again, if we eliminated poverty, we eliminated the need for people worrying about how they're going to pay their bills. You would eliminate a lot of crime. And I always say, build more schools, not more jails. Unfortunately, in this country, we build more jails.
Oh, and we've privatized them. And so they're corporations, and the first rule for corporations is they must make a profit for their shareholders. So
exactly.
they promise to keep, you know, these new prisons, like, what, 90-some percent full, which means that we have these stupid, stupid laws, like three strikes and different things, you have these people in there for having enough weed for themselves or something.
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
It is just.
And I know a case of a guy, for example, you talk about three strikes. This is in California. They don't have it in North or South Carolina, but they do in California, the three strike rule. He's in prison for the rest of his life possessing less than an ounce of marijuana. And the reason is because he had two prior convictions.
Oh.
And one of them was 10 years prior to the last conviction.
See?
Under the three-strike rule, he went to prison for the rest of his life.
That is such bull.
But it's the way some of these states operate. Because, again, it's always follow the money. It's always follow
sure.
the money.
Isn't it?
And
always, yes.
And again, it's always about what the rich in this country, this, and I don't even say the rich, the super rich, the way they manipulate the system, the way Mitt Romney can get away with paying 12% in tax while the rest of us paying 30% of our income, you know that is the most horrific thing that some of these people pay no. I mean, BP paid no taxes for like 3 years and got subsidies on top of it.
Cooperation. It's like,
they paid no taxes. But we have to pay all our taxes, or, you know, the IRS could come knocking at our door and put us in federal prison if we don't pay our taxes.
Right. We'll be there with the guy who had under an ounce of marijuana.
Exactly.
I don't know. I mean, sometimes we just have to almost laugh. And I mean, we're not laughing at the situation, but it's either laugh or cry sometimes, because it's so horrendous. No scriptwriter would ever have thought of any of this.
This country has changed. And the change, and I was just talking to my friend earlier before you called, the change in this country really came with Ronald Reagan. That this country has become so anti-worker. And, I mean, he started off by firing the air traffic controllers.
This was a pivotal point.
And that's when the war on the middle class began. You know, in feudal societies, you know, back in the Middle Ages, there was no middle class.
Right.
It was the rich and the peasants. That was it. And that's what they want to make this country again. They want to make this country into a feudal society. That is the goal. And they laugh about it. And they actually come out and say it at times. That's the amazing thing.
You have people who just don't want to believe it. Before you go, Patrick, I wanted to ask you about cooperatives like Mondragon in Spain. And we have, you know, some going on here. Cleveland is beginning to have a few cooperatives there and other areas. Do you think that this is going to really spread?
I do. I think that is a thing that's going to happen when companies stop closing, is the workers are going to start taking over the companies.
I saw warm and fuzzy over it myself. I mean, ever since I discovered Mondragon and then started reading about it, it's just like, oh, yeah, this has to be the future. It's exciting. So I think that
the one in Spain even rotates their manager so that somebody isn't always the manager.
Yeah. They have it down, and they even have the hospital is a cooperative. Their banks, you know, they've got something like 180 different companies that are part of it, and they all each operate as a cooperative. It's amazing.
Well, you know, that in this country, you know. The credit unions, what people need to put their money in, because those are cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
The insurance company that I get my car insurance and my house insurance through is USAA, which is a cooperative. It's not a for-profit company. It's a cooperative. It's owned by the members. And every year we get a rebate based on how much money the company makes. Like this year it was like, you know, $300 or $400. Well, it's not usually very much. But every member gets a rebate based on how much they pay in for their car and house insurance and whatever, life insurance, whatever they have through USAA. It's a cooperative. It's owned by the members. We vote for the board of directors.
That's what we should be looking for then now. I mean, we should be looking to do business with cooperatives right now that are already in existence. And then, you know, think about getting into others. Like there's food co-ops. They've been around for a while.
They've been around a long time.
Yeah, exactly. So there's things that are, you know, possible to do. And I always tell people, I mean, if, you know, we're going to make the change from the ground up. It's not going to come from up down. So if people want to get involved in local politics or something, if they think they can stomach it, they really should be. I mean, get involved.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm glad you said that, because You're familiar with Pat Noble, right?
Nice.
In New Jersey?
The name sounds familiar, but no, I can't.
He was elected to the school board in New Jersey running as a socialist.
Okay.
And he got elected school board. And the whole idea is if we can get people of like mind, of socialists, onto school boards, onto town councils, that's where the change is going to come. Let's face it, we're not going to elect a socialist president.
No.
We're not going to elect too many. We probably won't elect many socialists to Congress, if any. But we can elect people at the local level that can make changes at the local level. And the movement has to be a grassroots movement from the bottom up. It can't be
right.
from the top down.
Right. That's it. And that we can do. Because, you know, then when you have enough on the ground, then it starts rising.
Then you can make changes. And, you know, when you make change at a local level, you make lasting changes. And a lot of these local elections and a lot of municipalities are nonpartisan elections, which means they don't run as a Democrat or a Republican
yeah.
or a socialist.
Yeah.
So it's easier, I think, for a socialist to get elected to those because they're not running under a party line.
Right. They're running on issues.
They're running on the issues, right.
Yeah.
And when people hear the issues that socialists put forth, they agree with them.
Yes.
It's just when they hear the label socialist that they close their mind to it.
Yes.
They think of communism, Stalin, whatever. I mean,
right.
They don't have
the right view on what communism is. They don't know what socialism is. But those words, they're trigger words. They're the four-letter words, even though
they're the four-letter words. You know, and people talk about free market capitalism. Well, there is no free market. You know, that everyone pays for the market. There is no free ride. You know, they criticized Obama during the election when he said, "You didn't build this," because he was right. Why do companies prosper? They have infrastructure that's built by the government. That's socialism.
Yeah, wow.
The government builds roads. The government builds the internet is a result of the government. The internet came about because of government.
Government and the military way back.
The government.
Yeah.
These things that support businesses and that support growth, support small businesses, they are socialists. They are socialists. That's socialism.
So that's
you can't build a road to your factory.
No.
into your customers. You don't have the capability to do that.
Right.
So you have to depend on the government to do that, which is fine. That's what the government's there for. But it's socialism.
That the government actually is supposed to be helping us take care of these things, not going off to fight and kill people in other countries because we're backing up some corporation that could care less about us. I wanted to say Patrick is on Facebook, and also you can go to socialistpartysc.org. And also the SomervilleJewishCommunity.com.
The Socialist Party South Carolina is on Facebook, as well as there's a Facebook page people might enjoy called Conservatives Are Fascists.
That's right. Conservatives are fascists. I'm sorry, I should have said that. Yes, because this is what we know. Patrick, thank you.
That comes from Henry Wallace, Vice President of the United States.
Well, see? But thank you so much for coming by. I always love having you around.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, have a good weekend, and we'll see you soon.
Okay, thank you. You have
a
great night, and thanks again for having me.
All righty.
Okay, and bye-bye.